Welcome to We Mentor Mondays podcast with Nancy. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your peers on the entrepreneurial journey of self-discovery. Learn something new from our stories today. Welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast program. Today in the studio, we have Dan Prosser here for a second mentoring conversation. And he and Scott Plum own CEO Blueprint. For more than 45 years, Dan Prosser has been a successful entrepreneur, CEO mentor and coach, team educator, software developer, speaker, and author. His work with clients has created Fortune 500 to 5,000 fastest growing and best place to work companies. Dan has served as chief strategist on board of directors for nonprofits. His independent research into best place to work companies has uncovered a unique understanding of the distinctions that exist within these exceptional workplaces, distinctions that make them achieve 2 to 3 times the growth of non-best companies. In 2015, he published his book, 13ers, Why Only 13% of Companies Successfully Execute Their Strategy, and How Yours Can Be One of Them. Dan has lived in Silverthorn, Colorado, in the heart and soul of the Rocky Mountains, and Houston, Texas, and recently moved back to Minnesota, which is where he grew up. And so we were getting some insights from our first mentoring conversation about kind of how you grew up in a very entrepreneurial family. You're one of five. And
the oldest of five. I want to be clear about that.
Yes, of course. Claim your spot.
Claim my spot.
Yeah. And through your dad's, being involved with Green Giant and 3M, bought a staffing business, got into home care, and then eventually started RTW, Return to Work, mm-hmm. because he noticed a reverse salient concept of finding a weakness in the workers' compensation
system,
yep. where people weren't getting back to work. They were getting stuck on drugs or just getting a...
That says it all right there.
A learned helplessness.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Pain,
right.
Actually get addicted to pain.
Yeah, right. And so it's just interesting that your dad, saw that there's a better way for people to be in the world and they can actually recover from these workplace accidents and get off of the pain medication and be productive citizens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Yeah. And so to watch him in action and to see that, he grew up in these different industries where you were mentored, really, about how you just get into an industry and totally try to understand what's going on in it and then see where you can plug yourself in.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, and you've done that yourself.
I've done that for myself. Yeah.
Yeah. For yourself.
Yeah.
So the things that I could see.
Yeah.
That kind of surprised me even, how did I see that? As I was growing up and seeing that there was a weakness in the temporary help business, they called it back in those days, and there's like a weakness in that business. And then there's a weakness in the telecom business and there's a weakness in business in general. I also realized that these weaknesses are where billion-dollar companies get created. So the mm-hmm. people who are incredibly successful, are capable of seeing and able to see weaknesses in the systems. And it's these gaps that get created because a reverse salient, as I talked about last time, this concept called the reverse salient is not one that people talk about much. It's a military term. It's used in the military, but it applies to... We've applied it to business.
Yeah.
It doesn't really apply
to business.
I'd never
heard of it until I started talking to
you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it describes the way military attacks an enemy. So
they find a weakness in the system. Yeah.
Well, no, it's a bow. And so that bow is going against the enemy. And if the enemy pushes back hard enough, it'll create a backward bow in an advancing front.
See.
It's that backward bow that it creates the weakness. Now, what's really significant about reverse salience is that people actually try to avoid reverse salience. because they look like failures. They look like gaps, and people don't want to have gaps, you know?
Yeah.
Yet inside companies, inside these companies that are not best place to work companies, are these weaknesses in their systems. Then they have clients. They have, you know, they're in business, but, you know, they're providing something that they're good at providing usually. Like, they're good at trading. They're good at real estate. They're good.
Yeah.
But what they're not looking at is, where are the weaknesses that they uniquely can fulfill on? You know, where can we find the gaps that create the opportunities, that create the places that only a few people will see and fall into, sometimes fall into, but by seeing that weakness, you can create a business around that. And that's what I did in the telecom business.
You know, it's interesting because I just saw Warren Buffett's becoming Warren Buffett.
Mm-hmm.
It's on Netflix, and so it's about Warren Buffett's earlier years, well, about his life.
Yeah.
And he talks about the cigarette butt approach,
mm-hmm.
where he would look at the butt of a cigarette, so companies that were not doing great, but there was just enough life in them that he felt like they could resurrect them and help them turn them around and make them profitable.
He's one of those people who can see reverse salience.
Yeah.
He sees where the weaknesses are, and he picks up companies and then turns them into a stronger company. I mean, Dairy Queen.
And he does it through making sure that, you know, he circles himself with great people and gives them the autonomy they need to really do great work, using the strengths that they have.
Exactly.
To work together and build really solid teams.
Yeah, he's uniquely able to see that. And I looked at the Fortune 500 list this morning because it came out recently.
Yeah.
He's number two. His company's number two on the Fortune 500.
And he's considered the wealthiest man in the world.
Yeah.
I didn't know it was in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what they said in this documentary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's an interesting study. But you can see that what he's able to see is weaknesses. And people who are capable of seeing that, I believe, are the people who create the opportunities in the world. And that's kind of what I'm committed to today. That's why I wrote 13ers, is because my whole life has been about identifying weaknesses and helping people identify the weaknesses that they can fill best.
Yeah. Well, and you also talk about, like, the conversation, you know, that the world of work has shifted.
Yeah.
In the beginning of your book, you have two relational psychologists
who
write the foreword.
Yes.
And they focus on the history. So the mm-hmm. intersection of the world of business and relationship to science.
Yes.
And
so Harville Hendricks and his wife, Helen, mm-hmm. are very good, close friends of mine. And
Helen LaKelly Hunt. Yeah.
She's a family member of the Hunt family in Dallas, the oil family. And Harville wrote the book, Getting the Love You Want. And Oprah discovered the book. And had him on her show 19 times. Now, I did some work in Imago therapy with somebody in Houston, and I began to learn about this, and she was on the board of Imago and was coming off the board, and I was a client of hers, and she said, you know, I think you ought to look at maybe being on this board. You might bring something to it. And she nominated me for the board. And that's how Harville and I met and got to be really close friends. And he was willing to do this forward. Now, in the forward, he's giving a little history. It's funny because my publicist at the time of the book came out was very upset that I had such an academic forward to a business book. It was the perfect mix for this book, because what it talks about is how through the ages, we didn't really own ourselves. And so passing on down through the years, we literally did not own land. We didn't own ourselves, you know, the monarchy did. But yet through the Industrial Revolution and into more modern times, we began to get independence.
Yeah.
And that independence created the individual. And the individual is what really has impacted modern business. It was through the ages that this individual became powerful.
Yeah.
And it worked very well for many years. But it's not what people want today. Today, people want a relationship. They want to be connected.
Well, and I like the way they talked about monologue. Yes. So, you know, your boss will talk to you. You listen.
Yeah.
And it isn't like a dialogue back and forth.
No.
But it's more of them talking to you and telling you what to do.
Exactly. Most conversations are what we call in this business of understanding the human element of business is the parallel monologue. So you're having your conversation.
Yeah.
And I'm having my conversation. And so we're going along, but we're not really connecting. But what people are really wanting when they really begin to understand the possibility
yeah.
is they want to have a connected, not a disconnected. So I had that training from him. I also had training from some other places to understand what we call the ontological science of being, you know, what it means to be a human being and what is it that we want. And so I brought that in and to write the book. And I began to see that business is a conversation. And I mentioned this in the last segment, is that we measured this conversation about giving money back at the front desk of a hotel. Mm-hmm. Because we understood that business is a conversation and that information can change that conversation.
Yeah.
So if we give people the right information, the right perspective, then we can alter their behavior and that's what we want. We want to help people get stronger and fulfill on what they want out of their life. And that's done through connectedness. That's the ultimate, is being connected. So
yeah. So there needs to be like a back and forth dialogue. And they talk about the relational value system.
Yes.
Yeah. And I thought that was a nice way to talk about when you're having dialogue, that really in the information age, we really need cooperation.
Yes.
People are looking for cooperation, collaboration,
co-creation.
And also co-creation.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was such a nice way to kind of move into what you write about with building connectedness.
Yes. So there's two value systems in the world.
Okay.
There's the individual value system, which is the individual taking care of themselves and they're in it for themselves. And then there's the relational value system. And companies mirror these value systems. So you'll find companies that are really kind of plugged into the individual value system as being very highly transactional.
Yeah.
And then you've got the relational value system. And so what I do is I train people in how to identify the relational value system within their company and begin to connect with each other in a profound way. That's very different than just coming in and telling people how to do something better.
Yeah.
But they begin to see for themselves, you know, where are the reverse salients within the company? Where's our weaknesses?
Yeah.
And where's our gaps and how do we address those gaps? And then how do we become a relational company, non-transactional, so that we can provide what I call a signature experience?
But if you look at like, I'm hearing what you're saying.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think about like, if there's a service business, like for example, those who are placing people in headhunters. So they're mm-hmm. placing people, and I'm thinking about if you're running a business where you're a headhunter,
mm-hmm.
Your whole business model is about transactions. Like people need you, you know, a company needs you in a very intense way, you know, when they have a position that they need filled. And then once it's filled, they don't have a need for you. Is this different than what you're thinking
about?
Yeah,
I think that my real goal is to bring relationality, a relational paradigm,
okay,
to all of life. That, you know, business is just happens to be the biggest part of life where I can make a difference. I'm not a psychologist, so I can't impact marriage, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Harville does that very, very well. I can bring to business,
yeah,
a different way, a different perspective of business, that business is a conversation, and that the kind of conversations, the quality of the conversations, and the quantity of the quality conversations are what impact the success of that business. And so coming in and uncovering these conversations that undermine and sabotage business is key to first understanding how transactional we really are and beginning to understand inside the business, you know, where that becomes a weakness.
Yeah.
And then design the company as a signature experience internally.
First.
Because we have to do the work on ourselves first. In fact, I like to do the work on CEOs first, because that's where the really needs to change first.
Yeah.
And then work with a team and do the work that they need to do to begin to understand themselves better.
Yeah.
And see where, how individual they are. And then begin slowly to uncover the relational paradigm within the company and shift that paradigm, have a paradigm shift.
Yeah. Does that mean that they're changing their business model?
No, it doesn't.
As part of your work?
Actually not. This is really agnostic to the business model, because they can stay in the same business.
Yeah.
But now they're discovering something.
It's how they're in the business.
Yeah, discovering something like, oh, this reverse salient thing. Gosh, we've got that inside the company. What if we pointed our company at a reverse salient inside of an industry? So let's just say, what if we began to shift our company so that it was literally speaking to a reverse salient, a weakness, where the opportunities are?
Yeah. Can you give me an example of an industry or company that you...
Well, you know, the best example of that I run into all the time, because I like to shop there, is what I find at Nordstrom. You know,
yeah,
you go into Nordstrom and it's a very different experience than when you go into other stores. You know, I mean, I can point to Macy's as being more of a transactional place.
I see.
You
yeah.
go in, you don't have quite the same experience.
Yeah.
You just notice.
Nordstrom was built on the relationship.
Relational paradigm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And on shoes. You know,
shoes,
developing the relationship. Yeah, like the salesperson would develop a strong relationship and really understand their customer and what type of shoes they would like, and they would let them know, they would give them samples. I mean, they really, you know, develop the relationship with people.
Exactly.
And we've totally lost that.
Yes, and it's funny you say that, because I used to travel to San Francisco quite a bit in my businesses, and it's the only place I bought shoes was Nordstrom's in San Francisco. Because
their customers, they knew you.
They knew me and they took care of me, and I would haul home shoes, you know, because where else could I buy shoes like that?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I never took anything back in those days, you know, but, you know, what kind of company will just take something back because you bring it in and say, this thing isn't working?
Yeah. And so are you wanting to go back to more of that relationship piece?
Well,
Or do you feel most companies built now never had the relationship? Most companies now are built on transactions.
Most companies, well.
And they're fielding out people.
Yeah. The name of the book is 13ers. Why only 13% of companies successfully execute their strategy and how to be one of them? Because there's 87% of companies that are failing to execute strategy every year.
Yeah.
Those are the people who are not connected. They're disconnected organizations. They have conversations within their company that, you know, put people off.
Yeah.
You know, they're the people who will adjust the pay plan, you know,
mm-hmm.
and if you don't like it, don't work here.
Yeah.
You know, but then you know, they started talking about best place to work companies. Well, the thing is,
So that's part of what you added. You started noticing when you were working on the concept for the book about 13ers, you were noticing that in the best places to work companies, that there was something different going on there.
Yes. Now, I'd sold my two companies, the telecom company and I had a software company where we were literally taking and altering the conversation within companies through information. So we would grab information from our clients, you know, we would take information off their systems.
Yeah.
And we built interfaces. And this was our business, was to build an interface that captured information. And then we would sell that information back to the client in a new form, one that they couldn't put it into. And ultimately would give them the ability, and this is the hotel industry now, give them the ability to see what their P&L looked like every single day, rather than waiting until 45 days after the first day of the month and then realizing they had a problem. So we gave them the ability to manage their business better. But during that time, you know, I sold those businesses in 2001. I sold them in the same week,
so
both of them.
16 years ago.
Yeah. Same week, two different companies, both in Dallas, Texas, and my employees all moved up to Dallas. But the deal was I wasn't going to do that. But I went up there one day, and I met this guy who was doing the surveys for best place to work companies for the business journals. And he invited me to come to one of the luncheons and see what was going on. And I went, and these people got up on the podium and would tell the audience why they were a best place to work company. And I looked at them and I said, that's not a best place to work company. They don't even know why they're a best place to work company. You know, they're much grander than how they even understand it to be.
Oh.
He said, oh, well, you know, that's interesting. I was out in Temecula, California later that year, and where he's from, and I said, you know, we really ought to go find out why these companies really are not best place to work companies, especially, and why these few, so few are. And he went in the back room and he came out with a big pile of green bar paper, and it was all the surveys with all the comments and all the scores from the employees of all these companies that were best and non-best.
Okay.
And so I took the next 2 years and studied that and interviewed those companies. They were all in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the Houston surveys. And I discovered that there was some very interesting things going on. Now, in those years, Gallup was the company that did measurement inside companies. They're the ones that did most of the surveys. And so Gallup's approach is they were looking at engagement. That was their principle.
And they still do.
They still do.
Yeah.
They still do. They don't. But I had a different perspective. So I was listening for what people were saying differently. And I heard conversations that people were having and that the companies that were best places and the companies that were non-best places were literally having the same conversations, except they were just upside down in the non-best place to work companies.
Yeah.
So I had this experience with Imago, with Harville, and I understood connectedness. I understood how important it was. And I began listening to these people through their surveys and the connectedness. And so I discovered 9 things that seemed to be the common thread. And then one day I was working for a client, and I realized that the client was a pro bono client, a nonprofit, and they were trying to fundraise.
Yeah.
And they were having trouble fundraising, and they were happy to get checks and all of that, but they weren't very connected to the people that gave money, and they weren't really very contributable. So I went back to the surveys and I began looking and seeing that the companies that were led by people who were contributable, CEOs who are contributable, where they're willing to be contributed to by people in their company, so that literally their thinking could be changed by other people rather than coming into the company, oh, we know how to do this, and it's our way or the highway, which were the non-best place to work companies.
Mm-hmm.
All these connected conversations, I call them the connection points.
Yeah.
It was like a light bulb went on. It was like, holy cow, you know, it's not just engagement. It's something deeper than engagement that it really is the source of engagement.
Yeah.
So and if you can understand that.
Yeah, right.
And it's easy to do. It's fairly easy to understand it. It's 10 yeah. conversations that you find in company. I don't know why it ended up being 10, but only 10, but I'm sure there's a lot more.
Yeah, yeah.
But these are the 10 principal ones that I found.
Yeah.
And that's where the book, that's the genesis of the book right there.
Yeah. Well, I really like your book. And you also talk about not only connection points, but also execution virus, the entitlement virus. There are different viruses that seem to infiltrate in these yeah. companies that are part of the 87%, the empowerment virus. And then you, which is what I imagine through your CEO blueprint company, mm-hmm. is that you've got a blueprint for building 13ers.
I do.
Okay. And that's what the book too is also about.
Right.
And getting over inertia and all those other kinds of
exactly.
things.
Getting through chaos and understanding how to sit with chaos.
Yeah.
You know, most people are very restless around chaos. You know, it's like try to avoid it.
Yeah.
Most people who are in the 87% are working on avoiding instead of embracing.
Yeah.
And that's what really gets them.
Yeah.
That's what really stops companies.
Sure.
So I labeled them viruses because they kind of infect a company, and you know, it's a thinking way of thinking that infects an organization.
Yeah.
Obviously they're not real viruses, but
yeah.
it's a way
of the concept of the meme
undermines. Yeah, the concept of the meme. The meme is a conversation that can totally undermine and sabotage a business. And it's one that runs in the background. Most CEOs think that they run their businesses.
Yeah. So what is a meme?
Well, a meme is simply a background conversation. It's what we call contextual conversation. And that means that it runs in the background. It's not a foreground conversation like we're okay. having right now.
Yeah.
But it's in the background saying things like, I'm incapable of doing something, or like for example, me, might as well use myself. One of the things that I discovered about the meme was when I first started out in this, I was going around talking to people and they were like, you know, I think they were rolling their eyes when I left, but I remember walking down the street in Houston from a meeting and thinking to myself, this is like a voice coming out of the ether saying, no one wants what you have to offer. Mm. No one wants. It's like, God, what the heck? You know, no one really wants what I have to offer. And it's like, you know, as a result of that, I didn't pick up the phone. I wouldn't go and talk to people about it as much. But I discovered that, you know, this was just a hidden conversation. You know, it's a hidden contextual conversation.
Internal critic.
And the internal critic, a lot of people talk about this conversation that people have in their back of their minds. Well, I just call it a meme because in a company,
yeah,
memes are viral and they spread from mind to mind and they infect the way people operate together.
Yeah.
So if you can uncover that meme and tell the truth about it, give yeah. it the light of day, you can literally invent a new meme, one that is empowering and it gives people their power back.
Yeah.
And then you can actually give people a new place to stand with a meme. So mine was, no one wants what I have to offer. Well, I had to invent something new, and I didn't want to invent something too crazy.
Yeah.
You know, but it was crazy. You know, it's like it became I am, so it's an I am statement. I am the answer. And it wasn't like an arrogant I am the answer. It was an I am the answer as a stand. And so when I...
It was empowering.
It was empowering for me.
Totally.
It gave me my power back. And yeah. I would be able to sit down with people. Before I come into this interview, I remind myself, hey, I am the answer. Not like I'm some know-it-all guy.
No, this is coming from a place of empowerment.
Yeah,
it's not coming from a place of attached to the ego.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, this
I got
been...
plenty of ego to go around, I'm sure.
Well, we all can get trapped in our ego, but that's why you're doing the work, you know, of detaching from your ego and really doing something great for other people.
Yeah.
And really helping people to understand what's their own companies better.
Yeah.
So thank you for being here. I've loved
thank
both
you.
Of our conversations. And Thanks. We've had a couple of other conversations prior to this that have been just terrific.
Yeah. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, you're Thanks. Welcome. And I want everybody who's listening and those who read the blog that I write the post for each episode that to go out and buy your book.
13ers.
13ers. All right. Be one of the 13%.
Yes, yes, for sure.
Okay.
Thanks. Thank you very much, Nancy.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it.
And thanks, Mike Cabea, sound engineer, photographer, brother from another mother. We'll see everybody next week.
Do you want to promote your business and grow in your leadership skills? Here are a few ways you can promote your business and get leadership help through We Mentor, Inc. You can be a podcast guest. Challenge yourself to share who you are on air. We'll help you out. Secondly, you can sponsor our podcast program. You can invest a small fee to have you and your company name announced at the beginning and end of one or more shows. The third way that you can promote your business and grow in your leadership skills is you can set up an individual strategy session to do work one-on-one with me, focusing on specific life and leadership issues and skills you want to acquire. Or the fourth way is you can join an entrepreneurial leadership and mentoring lab. These ELM labs start throughout the year. They are small groups of 5 to 9 business owners who are out to profoundly shift their lives and lead with authenticity. In 2016, I became a registered yoga instructor and mindfulness meditation teacher. I also became certified online with Brené Brown's Brave Leadership and Courage Works courses to learn an effective process of being all in, falling, getting up, and trying again. In turn, I can mentor others in how to dare greatly and rise strong. I feel better equipped to help you forge ahead in these times of great uncertainty. Our Entrepreneurial Leadership and Mentoring Lab process is an integrated approach to leadership development. We do yoga, meditation, and leadership revolution skill setting. Yes, we will help you learn how to strengthen your body, strengthen your mind, and increase your emotional stamina as part of our leadership development process. Along with learning about real-world business planning and strategic planning, we do what works. Get involved, get started. You can reach me at 612-804-8920 or go to wementor.com and connect with us. Lastly, if you like our podcast program, help us keep it going. You can donate to our program. Just go to the wementor.com website, click on Buy button, and fill in the donation amount that you would like to contribute. We appreciate any and all contributions. See you next week.